We're going to talk now about the great distance between intention and act. And Dr. O'Toole is going to help us see that through the eyes of the people he works with and to inspire us and fill us with the knowledge we need to meet those challenges ourselves. Dr. O'Toole?
Thank you, Bruce. I need to first thank Stephen for inviting me back up here. It's always a great thrill and pleasure to be back in Pittsburgh, and to have blue skies today as well is really in the bonus category there. So thank you once again. I don't want to disappoint Bruce in particular, but I doubt inspiration, perhaps perspiration, will be coming out of this. But I want to thank all of you who have stuck it out. The advantage of being the last speaker is clearly that the caffeine is wearing down and the fatigue is setting in, so bear with me there. If I were to paraphrase this presentation, however, I would want to call it bringing research home, and really bringing research home both figuratively and literally. The reality of why we do what we do is to hopefully to try to make a difference, both in expanding our sphere of knowledge, but also to impact upon the stakeholders for which research does bear relevance. And I think as researchers, we all need to ask ourselves that question, is are we really falling into that mandate, which is, I think, an extremely important one, both in terms of understanding and knowing our communities, as well as making sure that the work that we do is relevant and tangible to the stakeholders involved. And that includes being objective advocates and being objective activists in the research that we do and the research questions that we ask and how we pose and phrase our answers and as well as our questions, so that there can be a better interface between policymakers and researchers, between interventionists, between care providers and researchers. And it's a connection that isn't always there, unfortunately. First slide, please. The focus of this talk is really to try to center on or bring some tangible capacity to it in relation to race and homelessness. And what I'm going to be doing is talking about race and homelessness and trying to relate it specifically to some Pittsburgh data. The reason why it's important and the reason why it's relevant to this discussion is a couple different issues. One is there's a concentration of adverse health outcomes among homeless individuals. The health needs are confounded by social and basic sustenance needs that clearly define homelessness and how homeless people survive. And more importantly, more interestingly, homeless individuals interact and interface within many points of entry. They are not an invisible population. And looking into our criminal justice system, looking into our emergency department population, looking at our inpatients, our inpatient censees, all really reflect the fact that we are interacting with this population, but we may not necessarily know it. And that's why it raises the other issue of bringing research home. And finally, effective understanding and engagement really requires a shift in the way we do our business as usual. And it requires a different way of asking questions, a different way of going about questions that we ask. And it's a challenge that I think we all need to think about as we start to address the broader issues of health disparities, the broader issues of Healthy People 2010 objectives, and the broader issues of 100% access and 0% disparity objectives. Next slide, please. The focus for the talk today is really going to center around, and I'll try to be as brief with these issues. One is first talking about the appropriate pedagogies that need to be applied, and I promise you this is my only research slide, so hopefully it won't be too bad. Two is trying to conceptualize homelessness within a community, and this is where we'll be drawing on much of our Pittsburgh data to hopefully draw some specifics to it. Next is the discussion really of how race affects homelessness and to really draw on the application of some of these principles and how these data are interpreted. And finally, and interspersed throughout, is really discussing how the cultural and structural nuances to becoming, surviving, and getting out of homelessness interact within not only the research arena, but also the policy arena, and how we as researchers need to make sure that we're working effectively to help people in the trenches, both in the state houses, local public health agencies, as well as in provider networks, to do a better job. Next slide. In terms of pedagogic approaches, it's important to put this into some sense of context. I'm on the research track in health services research at Hopkins, and previous to my position at Hopkins, I had a similar role here in Pittsburgh and had been here for about 8 years. And one of the things that we are taught and we are trained and we are conditioned and cultured into is that academic success for a tenure-track researcher is defined by NIH funding and publications in peer-reviewed journals. And how you get there and what you do really is irrelevant to that bottom line of NIH funding and peer-reviewed publications. The problem is, and particularly when we start looking at special need and vulnerable populations, is that the community is left out of that equation. And there is a premium that is both we are taught and we are trained to focus on randomized controlled trials as the gold standard. Secondary data analyses is the quick jump start to an academic career. Get your data from a community, but you know that's where it begins and that's where it ends. And unfortunately, we lose our focus as researchers and we lose our mandate and accountability of researchers if we buy into that academic set of objectives and academic set of standards for success. So that the traditional orientation to our research in disease-oriented modeling, point-of-contact epidemiology, where you find them in the most convenient context, autopsy records, morbidity and mortality data, emergency department data, or isolated interventions, where we focus on one small element, how do we drop cholesterol levels down? An anecdotal story, when I first started working with the homeless here in Pittsburgh, I was very ambitious and very global in my approach, and I remember having an opportunity to do cholesterol screening among the homeless. And I thought it was a great idea for a while until finally some of my more wise mentors from the community informed me otherwise. And I think we have to keep that big picture in mind quite often when we go about this work. And so what's very important when we approach community-based research is we approach it from the context of what type of pedagogies, what type of approaches and methodologies can be applied rigorously, can be applied scientifically, but that are sensitive and appropriate to the communities that we're trying to work in. Contextualizing outcomes so that we're not worried about lowering the low-density lipid profile of people who are living in the streets and eating out of dumpsters. Applied behavioral theory. Much of the work in homelessness has been utilizing some of the Anderson and Newman behavioral theory work, looking at predisposing, enabling, and illness-oriented factors related to health access and health services, health service seeking. It's very important for us to contextualize, but be very cognizant to how we contextualize and making sure that it's appropriate to the setting that we're working in. And finally, and I think most importantly, and the mandate to the institute that I currently direct at Hopkins is establishing and developing and modeling community-based participatory research so that our accountability to the populations that we're working in, our accountability to the populations that we are trying to serve, and so that the effect of our research is to truly make a difference in the communities that the work is ongoing in is applied. And using community-based participatory research methodologies, where community participation in developing the research question, community participation in the full data implementation and data interpretation, and community participation in developing a sustainment and implementation strategy after the 3-year funding cycle ends, is put on the table at the beginning. And that's extremely important, and it's something that I think needs to be emphasized as we start looking at making a difference in vulnerable communities. And I promise you that's my last research pedagogy slide. Next slide, please. In terms of some of the work that we've been trying to do in this area, and I need to applaud the Allegheny County Health Department for their support in this effort, because they've been the funder of many of the projects and have been very supportive of the projects we've been engaged in. Since 1995, we've been engaged in several different health access initiatives, looking at access to care and utilization of services among vulnerable populations here in Pittsburgh. The successes that we have had from that are reflected by a couple of specific items or I think strategies that have been very critical to this process. We've used people from the community as part of our data collection team, formerly homeless people who know where homeless individuals reside, who have a credibility that I would not be able to maintain or establish. They are the people who drive the research projects, and it's extremely important. They are vested in the outcomes, and they are vested in this process, and they are part of the process, and it legitimizes the programs, and I think it fully legitimizes the programs rather than does it in a tokenized way. We have a community advisory board that's been involved in both developing the study questions, providing feedback to the process, as well as trying to, and we aren't always as successful as we'd like, of disseminating the information locally so that it can be used internally so that we're not waiting for a New England Journal of Medicine publication for something to be disseminated. We've pursued an ecologic approach towards identifying and sampling the population. And some things that, you know, would seem obvious are things we oftentimes forget. You don't want to try to sample homeless people in January. You're going to find many more of them in June. This is Pittsburgh. We're not in Palm Beach. There are no hanging chads in Pennsylvania. But these are things that we forget. Modeling our recruitment strategies to when entitlement checks are distributed is another significant issue. And unless you are immersing yourself in the culture of homelessness and the realities of homelessness, these are things that are oftentimes forgotten. And these are things that oftentimes we can't appreciate when we're relying on large administrative data sets or national data sets. Another example of this is that in trying to conduct some research similar to this in Baltimore, the community of East Baltimore, which is where I work and where the communities that I work with, one-third of the households don't have telephones. So any telephone-based survey instrument is obviously null and void for this population. And these are things that are very important as we try to target and focus our efforts towards vulnerable and traditionally disenfranchised populations. The result of that is we've had greater than 90% participation rate in the studies and the surveys and the projects we've engaged in, which has really been a phenomenal response rate, and it's allowed us to have some degree of confidence in the data that have been produced from it. The focus of these studies, as I mentioned, have been on healthcare access and utilization. Next slide, please. To put the focus of this discussion in some sort of context, homelessness, as we know in America, is a very substantial and significant problem, and it has been for quite some time. To bring it home, 7.5% of the United States population will experience homelessness at some point in their lives. This is something that is very real and unfortunately has the capacity to grow significantly in the next several years. As we all know, there are multiple etiologies for the homelessness. The most important thing to keep in mind is one size does not fit all. The average age of death of a homeless person is 47 years, which is a staggering statistic considering it's about 30 years less than the domiciled population. There's obviously a high burden of illness, but there's also high levels of health service utilization. And that is significant because it broadens the scope of stakeholders who have an interest and a staked interest in what the outcomes are. And it's very important as we engage in this research process that we know who our audience is, be they policymakers, be they insurers, be they safety net providers, be they traditional healthcare providers, be they the general public that needs to be aware of these things, and tailoring our research so that it can appeal and respond to the concerns and issues of these stakeholders is extremely important. It's also important to think about what we do in terms of a societal response, and some of Nancy Krieger's work previously talked about some of the attitudes towards minority populations among majority populations, and much of that is exemplified by the societal response to homelessness, where we see both reactive and proactive policies. And we as researchers need to make sure that we are part of that fray so that the societal response can hopefully be an informed response. And that's an important consideration to make. Next slide, please. Here in Pittsburgh, in thinking about homelessness, it's always important to think about it from a historical perspective and from a local perspective. And this is one of the great joys I had in my time here in Pittsburgh, was the opportunity to work with many of the service providers, some of whom are here today, and to work with the clients and have a better understanding of what it really meant to be homeless in Pittsburgh. Because oftentimes homelessness, as with other conditions, are very different depending upon where one lives. As we know, Pittsburgh has been undergoing a significant shift in its economic base from industry to service. Accompanying that has been a tremendous outflow of individuals from Pittsburgh. I find more Pittsburgh Steeler fans in Baltimore probably than I knew even existed. We probably see more Cordell Stewart jerseys than Raven jerseys down there, if it's any solace. We have a very aged population here, and whether it's first or second depends upon what time of year you're asking the question. But more importantly, 21.4% of our population and over 15% of the families live in poverty. And the degree of inequity that we see in our community is very pronounced, and it's very real. And as we think about homelessness, we need to think about it in the context of poverty and in the context of income inequity. But also important, and it's very easy to paint a very dire picture, but now having lived in different cities and in different contexts, it's very important to recognize that we have a very strong social services network. We have very strong community leadership. We have a very proactive and strong local foundation community, and we have a very strong resource base in our higher education institutions. And it's very important that we build on the strengths as we look to the problems. Next slide, please. If you're African American in Pittsburgh, these are some statistics that are important to keep in mind, not only as we think about homelessness, but the whole landscape of being an African American in Pittsburgh. A quarter of the city population and about slightly over 10% of the county population is African American. The population concentrations have traditionally been in the 3rd and 5th wards, the Hill District, and the 12th and 13th wards, East Liberty and Homewood-Rushton. And that's a statistic that hasn't changed since 1910, when we first started seeing large migration of African Americans into Pittsburgh in response to the industrial opportunities here. Infant mortality, and this is obviously dated statistics that have thankfully improved since 1991, showed an infant mortality rate of 25 per 1,000, I apologize for the error here, 25 per 1,000 live births of African American babies versus 8.8 per 1,000 live births among white babies. And as I mentioned, thankfully, through the efforts of the health department and the Healthy Start program, those statistics have improved significantly. But the disparity still exists. Mortality, and to follow up on Rashad Birdsong's comments, which I think were very much on the mark, mortality from violence is over 10 times higher among African Americans, and mortality from HIV almost 4 times higher among African Americans than whites. And this is mortality, not disease incidence. So, and particularly as we look at HIV, with the advent of protease inhibitors and other life-sustaining medications and interventions, they aren't making it into the African-American community as much as we'd like. And the age-adjusted death rate is equally prominent. Next slide, please. Here in Pittsburgh, we see approximately 1,500 to 2,000 homeless on any given night. Now, recall from the previous slide, 25% of the city's population is African American. Over 75% of the homeless population in Pittsburgh is African American. Median age is 38 years. Interestingly, almost two-thirds had accessed health care in the previous 6 months, and 70% had health insurance, according to our 95 data, and over half could identify an ambulatory care site. For Pittsburgh data, for homeless data across the country, that sounds pretty good, but it requires some further look. And as we look specifically at race and homelessness, as we delve into it from a culture and a cultural and a community perspective, it's important to think about it in three themes and in three contexts. First, how does race affect becoming homeless? Next, how does race affect accessing services once you're homeless? And finally, how does race affect getting out of homelessness? Because if we don't look at it in that broader context, there could be some some premature self-congratulations. There could be some premature finger-pointing, but we may not be getting the real picture. Next slide. The self-reported causes of homelessness were clearly dominated by substance abuse, as was the overall prevalence of ASAM-defined addiction and dependence among the homeless. But economic reasons of no money and job were also extremely important. Next slide, please. But what's very important, though, as we start thinking about causes and etiologies of homelessness is some work done by Chris North and her colleagues at Wash University, where they found that among African Americans who were homeless, they were homeless much more often for externally related causes of socioeconomic conditions, job loss, loss of benefits, as opposed to white homeless who oftentimes had more internally related causes related to substance abuse, mental health, and physical health problems. Next slide. So as once again we try to translate these research findings into a dialogue or into a communique that is effective at the policy arena and at the provider arena, it's important that we ask, that we pose these comments or we pose these findings in the context. What are the community avenues for economic advancement? Not just homeless avenues, but community avenues for economic advancement, particularly in the African American community. What are the safety nets when a crisis does occur? And how are homeless strategies linked to broader educational and vocational strategies? Next slide. Now, when we look at accessing services, the same dynamics are found. In our 95 data, where we surveyed 400 homeless people in the city of Pittsburgh and in the county, the proportion accessing health services were extremely pronounced, but there were some clear factors that were independently associated with who was accessing care and who wasn't. Having a medical illness and having health insurance were very strongly identified, as well as stable sheltering. If you are less concerned about having a roof over your head, if you're staying at Pleasant Valley Shelter or Light of Life Mission, as opposed to living out on the streets, you are more apt to be able to receive health care. As well as the social support network. The stronger social support network among homeless persons was associated with health service utilization. And finally, and most concerningly, the clock is ticking here, most concerningly, white race. Whites were twice as likely to be receiving health care as African Americans. Next slide. Some of the obstacles and barriers people identified for why they weren't accessing health care. Next slide. And from another study, which wasn't specific to homeless people, some of the experiences that African Americans versus whites had in the process of receiving health care, I think, also bear light to some of the problems that are had. Most concerning is that first statistic. When we asked if people were ever referred to a collection agency for a health care visit and for a health care expense, twice as many African Americans had been referred to a collection agency compared to whites. Similar disparities are evident in looking at the issue of difficulty in accessing care, as well as time for a visit and time in a waiting room. Next slide. So once again, when we look at the whole process of access of care and how it translates within a activist agenda, within a policy agenda, within a provider agenda, we need to ask, what are the structural barriers to care? Are providers and their staffs colorblind in the care that's being provided? And how does this affect ability to access other services? Next slide. In the issue of getting out of homelessness, what we focused on or try to look at here is the surrogate measure of substance abuse treatment. One of the things that we've found is that the prevalence of substance abuse needs among the homeless population here in Pittsburgh runs about 75%. 75% of the homeless are actively addicted or dependent on drugs and alcohol. When we looked at how many of them are actually able to access treatment services, we found some very concerning statistics. White homeless were almost twice as likely to be receiving substance abuse services in the previous 12 months compared to African American homeless. When we focused specifically on inpatient services, the difference became even more pronounced. 46% of the white homeless had gotten inpatient or residential treatment compared to 19% of the African American homeless in the self-report survey. And so if we look at what are the avenues for getting out of homelessness for an addicted person, substance abuse treatment obviously ranks very high up there, and it's a significant problem and a significant issue. Next slide. One issue that comes up then is that is Pittsburgh unique, particularly in this very disturbing statistic? Our survey looked at both at Philadelphia and Pittsburgh homeless, and unfortunately we did find that Pittsburgh was unique in this arena, and that the racial disparities in access to substance abuse treatment were not held out in our Philadelphia cohort that was surveyed similarly. So once again, we raised the questions from this data. What are the structural barriers unique to Pittsburgh, unique to the Pittsburgh system? And how have we contextualized an exit strategy from homelessness, and for whom is that exit strategy contextualized? Next slide. So finally, and in conclusion, the points I want to emphasize are, one, that racial disparities do extend into homelessness. And effective change really requires systemic review and reform. It's not just a matter of increasing the availability of penicillin, but rather we have to look very hard and deep at our system so that, you know, to take the analogy of the football field and the blade of grass, we need to go deeper than the blade of grass. And finally, and I think more importantly, from an overall process and an overall perspective, it's important to keep in mind that if we truly want to have an effect on the Healthy People 2010 objectives, if we truly want to have an effect on our 100% access and 0% disparity objectives, we need to be looking at the traditionally disenfranchised and vulnerable communities that represent a significant burden of illness. And to do that, we need to employ different methods and different approaches to how we do it. Thank you.